Evening, I'd like to welcome everyone to our July 5th, 2016 City Council Workshop. Call this meeting to order, and I'd like you all to please rise. And silently ask for a blessing upon this city and this city council as we make decisions that affect this community. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Item 1.4 on our agenda is the roll call, and all members except for Larry McCordy and Eugene Bain are present, so at this time, I would entertain a motion to excuse Larry McCordy and Eugene Bain from tonight's proceedings.
Make that motion.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We'll move to item 1.05, citizen input. This is the time any citizen has an opportunity to speak and address the fellow city council with any item or concern that they have. If anyone has anything they would like to address the council with, please raise your hand. I'll recognize you. You can step to the microphone, and you have up to 5 minutes. Is there anyone here who would like to address the council tonight? Okay, hearing none. We'll move to current business, and tonight, we have a special award for Abe Gomez. Abe, would you please come forward?
I'd like to say a few...
Okay, I'll start. It's hard to believe it's been 10 years, isn't it? But Abe has worked for the fellow police department for 10 years. Abe was a 2000 graduate of the Othello High School. He went on to obtain his bachelor's degree in industrial technologies from the University of Idaho in 2005. He's been a member of the Othello Police Department since July 15th of 2006. In 2007, he's awarded the Dispatcher of the Year Award. He has been the Teamsters Local 760 shop steward for our non-commissioned bargaining unit since 2009. And in 2014, he received a recognition letter and a life-saving pin. Outside of work, Abe enjoys spending time with his family and friends, volunteering with the Royal Rangers Program at the local Bethel Spanish Assembly of God Church. He loves to fish, camp, and golf, and I'm sure all of that is with your wonderful family over here. Well, at this time, if I may, I'd like to present to you a 10 years of service to Abdel Gomez, Abe Gomez, in appreciation for dedicated service to the citizens of Othello from 2006 to 2016. This is a wonderful milestone. Congratulations, Abe.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
There's some things I'd like you to know about Abe. Abe and I have worked together on many occasions, and there's some things I've discovered about Abe. First, it's very hard to replace experience and institutional knowledge. Abe is becoming that guy inside the dispatch where if I need to say, where's that computer, what's this going on, I go to Abe. Any kind of form I need made, I go to Abe. Abe's real good at it. Abe's a team player, and I found him to be a very, a man full of common sense, just what needs to be done right now, what's important now. And Abe, I really appreciate how detail-oriented you are, and you help us out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Abe? Abe, did you want to say a few words, please?
Can you make me do it?
Get the microphone, yeah.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank God for the opportunity to get me this job. them for the city, who actually granted me this position with the city. It's been great, a great 10 years. I've learned a lot. And thank my family also for supporting me through this changing schedules. It's been a rough go around for them, but I think I've learned a lot, and I love to serve my city. So here I am, and it's another 10, 20 years.
There you go. All right.
Thanks.
We'll move on to item 2. Thank you, Abe. Move on to item 2.02, water reports. And with us, we have an entourage of experts, consultants, engineers. And who are we calling on first? Is it Jesse? Okay. Jesse, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Appreciate it. So the agenda item, water reports, is a very broad topic. See if we can narrow it down for you. I'm going to start big picture here. The city's laid out a pretty lofty plan for growth in Othello, and basically the tool for doing that was the comprehensive plan, and that gave you the initial roadmap for what you wanted to see for growth and expansion of the city. And so growth in residential, commercial, industrial sectors, all of those are contingent upon adequate water supply and to some extent, the availability of wastewater treatment. The city recognizes the need to secure its water supply in order to realize the vision laid out in the comp plan, so that's what we're doing here. We're here to help the city secure the water supply to allow growth. And it currently appears, you know, that the city's reliance on groundwater may not be sustainable. There's regional decline of aquifers, and it appears that resource might be finite, so there's something needed in order to meet the growth plans that you've laid out. We've worked with the staff to outline a strategy for the city to pursue, which involves sort of a near-term to intermediate-term things to pursue, and then sort of longer-term things to pursue outside of that. So tonight we're going to be covering three different things. We're going to be covering new well siting recommendations, we're going to cover aquifer storage and recovery, and then industrial wastewater treatment and reuse. So the part that I'm covering here is the industrial wastewater treatment and reuse. And these are all different sort of pieces of the puzzle that we're going to put forward for the council's consideration in addressing future water supply. And then the team from ASPECT is going to cover the well siting recommendations and the aquifer storage and recovery. So with that, I'll launch in to industrial wastewater treatment and reuse. So the agenda for the stuff that I'm covering here is talking about where industrial treatment and reuse might fit into the overall water supply strategy, overview of reuse concepts, you know, introduction to the vocabulary and types of reuse that are out there. I'll give you guys some food for thought, I guess, on why the city might want to consider this as a key piece of the water supply puzzle. And then also some technical considerations that will come up more as we study the feasibility of industrial treatment and reuse. And then lay out some steps for the path forward. And, you know, this is a work session, so it's intended to be interactive. If you have a question or we use an acronym or any of that stuff, by all means, stop us and we can make this an interactive discussion, or I can just go right through the material. And I think same thing goes for Tim and Andrew's stuff as well. So that's where we're headed for the industrial treatment and reuse things. So as we already mentioned, reliance on groundwater in the, the overall water supply strategy that we're looking at for the city is initially to start off relying on groundwater. That's where you are right now. You're totally relying on groundwater. And it appears at some point in the future there's going to need to be a transition to some other source of water. So whether that's treated industrial wastewater or whether that's treatment of surface water from canals, there's some sort of transition that likely needs to occur in the future. And I've got some graphs and stuff that have the time frame for those, and we went over those last time I came here, but I'll put them up there just to refresh your memory when we get to that point. And in conjunction with potentially using some form of surface water or using treated industrial wastewater, aquifer storage and recovery might be a key piece of using either of those, because surface water through the canals is only available seasonally, so there's a gap in there where potentially water that was treated during the period of availability could be stored in the aquifer and then pulled out through the city's existing or even future wells. So that's one key piece of the water supply strategy. So what is industrial treatment and reuse? I'm not sure if that's a term that's just immediately familiar to the council or not, but it's come up for several reasons. Just the basic concept is that right now you have industries using a significant portion of the city's water supply, and right now that wastewater gets basically exported east of town and used for irrigation or stored in ponds when it's not irrigation season. And so, I guess what the concept is that instead of using it once and exporting it, if the city can reuse that water, potentially it just makes your water resources go further than they currently do. So industrial wastewater can be treated and reused for a few of these things. It can be used for more than this, but these are the kind of the main ones that we were putting forward for the city to consider right now to see if you guys agree that this is a concept you might want to pursue. So industrial wastewater could be treated to essentially the standard that the industrial users need to at the start of their process and recycled back in. That would be one option. Another option would be to treat it to, I think it's both drinking water standards and then also non-degradation standards for, and inject it into the aquifer and then withdrawn at a later date out of wells. So that would be another option. A third option, which from a regulatory standpoint isn't actually an option yet, but it's worth discussing in this context, would be if you could treat the industrial wastewater to drinking water standards and then put it right back into the drinking water system. So we'll talk about the reason that's not an option yet, but that it's worth discussing. So that's just sort of an initial introduction of the ways you could possibly use treated industrial wastewater. So this figure here, and I didn't create this figure, but I thought it was a pretty good one for our discussion, and I did have to modify it a little bit. But the regulators basically break reuse into sort of three main categories, and they're kind of up at the top here: non-potable water reuse, potable water reuse, and then de facto water reuse. And again, that's just sort of vocab that you may hear as we're going through the discussions of this. But the main concept that we're putting forward here, and it's kind of hard to read because that red arrow should use the white lettering, but so if this is our industrial users here, we have industrial wastewater going to a treatment plant and either getting injected into an aquifer, filtering down through the aquifer, getting withdrawn back out to wells and used in the city, or the one that isn't quite an option yet, but that may, I guess we've had some discussions with DOH and they were willing to consider potentially moving towards regulations that would allow this if the city could demonstrate that the water met all the applicable protections of public health, would be going directly from, so you go industrial waste to the treatment plant to direct potable reuse. So anyway, I think it's a good figure, but it's just kind of conceptual to show what the pathway would be for reuse.
Just one more clarification.
Sure.
To put it back in the aquifer, doesn't it have to be treated to treatment water standards at that point?
It does. Yeah. And so it's actually a little higher standard than drinking water standards. It's a non-degradation standard, correct? Yeah. So ecology actually has some requirements for putting it back in the ground that are actually higher than if you were just pulling it out of here and putting it in here. So it is a very high standard to meet. And but it is something that is feasible from a technology standpoint. So yeah, there's some nuance to that. So as far as why the city might want to consider industrial treatment and reuse, I already kind of touched on the fact that this gives the city an opportunity to make your water resources go further. So if there is a means to reuse it, as opposed to just essentially mining it out of the aquifer and then sending it east of town, then that's a good thing from a water supply standpoint. If you also have sort of the added benefit of offering then industrial treatment to industrial users, it allows for existing industries to expand potentially, and it also makes Othello very competitive from a standpoint of wooing other industries in the area. So there's other municipalities, other areas that would love to have the industry locate in their municipality, and so this is another potential benefit that you could offer to industries to locate or expand here. So those are the positive ones, the first three, and then just from a practicality standpoint, there's the uncertain long-term reliability of the aquifer, so it allows you to supplement that or at least to make it go further. And then there's also just a finite water right limitation, which some of these figures that I'll show later will touch on that as well. So in addition to that, if it penciled out from a cost feasibility standpoint, this potentially delays the need for purchasing and treating surface water. So there's a whole cost analysis that's needed basically to compare the cost of treating surface water to the cost of treating industrial wastewater, and then also whether there's some additional advantages and disadvantages to both of those, and what are the city's priorities. So there's an analysis that will need to happen there. So developing a water supply to augment groundwater is going to require constructing a treatment plant one way or another, whether it's a surface water treatment plant or whether it's an industrial treatment plant. So there's just sort of an analysis that needs to go on between those things. So I've got a pie chart here that shows, and I may have gone over this before in my other presentation, but the whole pie here is the total volume of water that Othello has rights to in groundwater right now. So right now, didn't give my category names. That's not very helpful. It shows up on my print, but I guess I can describe it. So the red one here is industrial use, and it's currently using roughly half of the city's available water rights. A quarter of the city's available water rights are used by non-industrial uses, and right now this one is the amount that's available for growth. So that's a bummer those didn't come in. The colors are the same as, well, I know it's probably fine. I just narrated it, so we'll get it next time. So this is a graph that was up there last time. So if this is projecting growth at the rate that's shown in the comprehensive plan, this is if industrial use just remained constant, so no new industries located in Othello, and this is the water rights limit. So whether or not you could have this kind of growth with no industrial growth is probably debatable, but if that were the case, you've got about 18 years before you reach your water rights limit. That's not saying that you actually have supply in that quantity, but that's just how much you would have the legal right to develop. And this is the other graph, where if you were hoping to attract additional industries, so each one of these little jumps here every 5 years is as if a new industry locates in town. So the take home of those two graphs is basically, if Othello wants to have large industries located in town, there's a water rights limitation. And a lot of it's driven by this orange portion down below. So that's just trying, kind of reinforcing the rationale of, hey, it makes sense to at least examine industrial treatment and reuse and see if there's a way we can sort of reduce this orange part and make this green part go further. So what that looks like then, so this one came in, that's good. If the city were to implement industrial treatment and reuse and reduce this portion from what was half of the pie down to just a quarter of it, so your current non-industrial use is roughly half, that would leave half the pie essentially for future growth. It would be non-industrial growth because new industrial users would be able to discharge and recycle in the same way that the existing ones would. So what that looks on a graph then is this orange portion, the industrial portion, gets much smaller, and then you have all this room in the future
figure out.
So, I mean, it's, I'm sure I'm probably beating a dead horse as far as the concept goes, but the visual is nice in that it goes from, instead of being 2015 out to, you know, 2030, 2032, takes it all the way out to, you know, kind of mid-century almost. And that's projecting the whole thing, 4.2% growth. And I know when we discussed it with Travis, that's more of a 20-year time frame, and so it may not be that steep out here. So potentially, this goes out even further. So it really is a long, potentially a long-term solution for the city in terms of water supply, if this turns out to pencil out from a cost efficiency standpoint. So jumping back to some technical considerations that are going to come up as we look at this in more depth. Level of treatment is going to be a big issue, you know, when we're comparing whether it's surface water treatment versus industrial treatment, because industrial treatment may require biological treatment. There may be inorganic contaminants require treatment. So a possibility on, or inorganic contaminants are also a possibility on surface water treatment. So there's some of these questions are going to get answered on through the ASR feasibility study, which Tim's going to go into greater depth on. And the thing that Fellow is waiting on from us is a proposal for the feasibility study of industrial treatment and reuse. So that's going to be the other part to be able to compare the two alternatives. So another thing that's going to affect the alternative that's proposed for industrial treatment and reuse would be whether the reuse is used through ASR, whether it's industrial process recycling, or whether it's direct potable reuse. And direct potable reuse would be the one with the highest regulatory hurdles and the most difficult to implement if the city wanted to pursue that. So in addition to that, this has sort of the interesting aspect of being a wastewater solution to a drinking water scarcity issue. So building a wastewater treatment plant might actually solve the drinking water scarcity issue. So that has sort of the interesting overlaps of, okay, which utility pays for and operates the facility? Is that reflected in the water system rates? Is it reflected in the sewer system rates? Is it both? So there's some interesting aspects from that side of it. And so the next step forward, as I mentioned, is technical analysis of feasibility of implementing industrial treatment and reuse. So we're going to bring a proposal to the city to investigate that, the feasibility of that, provide alternatives, cost estimates, probably help facilitate some discussions with stakeholders. And if it all pencils out from a technological and sorry, got ahead of myself there. From a technological and a regulatory standpoint, then getting all the stakeholders on board, getting the funders on board will be key. And at that point, or if all of that follows that path, then it's acquire funding, design and construct, operate and maintain. So that's the overview of industrial treatment and reuse. Can I answer any questions on specifics or broad questions on the topic?
So you're saying that the just a quick question for
sure.
My curiosity. You're saying that the regulatory requirements for what was it the ASR is actually more stringent than the direct potable use?
Well, it's kind of funny. So in some ways, yeah. So in order to take treated water and put it back in the ground, ecology has a standard, which I believe is basically called non-degradation of groundwater. Mm-hmm. And it's a higher standard than just pulling water out of surface water, treating it, and putting it into a drinking water system. The only thing, that's why I have the someday here, is that
there's no regulations.
Yeah, Department of Health doesn't actually recognize industrial wastewater as a drinking water source. It's basically groundwater and surface water, and they just don't even have regulations really to govern this. part of the reason probably is because, you know, I think at the moment, the majority of reuse in the state is from sanitary treatment and reuse, and so there's really high standards with that, and just kind of the whole public, you know, we don't want treated wastewater in our drinking water. Industrial has a separate set of treatment regulations and isn't really viewed the same, but because it's just kind of less common, DOH hasn't developed anything to make it a potable water source. So they are open to the idea, but it would require Othello to sort of blaze the trail in demonstrating, okay, this is what the initial source, you know, constituents in the initial source water are. If there's nothing too scary in that, you know, then demonstrating that the treated effluent is, you know, as good or better than drinking water standards. But it would require sort of blazing the regulatory trail.
And those standards have been set in other states,
I think other states are further ahead on this. Yeah. And it's interesting. I know Aspect does work in Oregon and other states, and so they may have some insight on that. But yeah, it's funny. You know, you're in Washington, and so you are where you are. You know, but other states are further ahead on some of that reuse stuff. I don't know that there's any direct sanitary potable reuse in the U.S. yet. I know there's talks about it in, you know, water poor areas, mm-hmm. and it's done in Europe. But yes, I don't believe it's stateside yet.
They're doing it in Flint, Michigan.
If I recall, I think somebody mentioned to me one time that they were possibly doing it in Arizona, in some of those areas.
Yeah, and at least my understanding at this point was that it isn't sanitary reuse. It's probably something more like this, you know, industrial reuse and treatment. But I'm not on the cutting edge there necessarily, so it's possible there's something out there.
Council? Okay. Thanks, Jesse.
All right, yeah, that's my part of it. And like I said, the Aspect team now is going to hit the well setting recommendations and aquifer storage and recovery. So again, make sure you get any questions posed to them that you have.
Can you pull up that other presentation? Good evening. I've been before the council before. It's a pleasure to be here again. Again, I'm Tim Flynn. With me is Andrew Ostring. Andrew's a hydrogeologist with Aspect and will be helping with the ASR feasibility study. So I want to cover two things. The first, and it ties back to what Jesse was saying, the groundwater supply source evaluation, you might view that in part as the short or near-term strategy for water supply. That is, as we look at greatly expanding water supplies to provide economic development, albeit surface water. In the meantime, it's to sustain the groundwater supply, which is the city's sole source of supply. So we've completed that work and recently submitted a memo to the city. I don't think staff has had a chance to review it, so that's going to be our next step. But I'll give you an overview on that, what we call task two. And that work was done under subcontract to Varela. The second, and I'm really excited to be here to talk about, is this aquifer storage and recovery feasibility study, which with the help of Spencer and Wade and others, it was a process, but the city has successfully received a grant to advance that, and I think it's a key component of the long-term water supply strategy. So I think it's a major milestone. Okay. So just focusing on the groundwater supply evaluation first, our scope covered three things. First was looking for opportunities just to expand the capacity of the existing well network. The city has a large number of water supply wells, and is there an opportunity to improve that, the collective pumping capacity? And I'll talk a little bit about some of the things that are in your control and some that are not in your control, albeit the more regional declines. Secondly, beyond just looking at what we can do to improve the well field, is where do we go from here in terms of expanding the groundwater supply in light of what we know? And then lastly, give you some sense about costs. And I'll preface this all by saying that, you know, I know you've sat through and have been presented some of the earlier work done by the, what I call GWAMA, Groundwater Management Area, and
they had some fairly dire forecasts. I think, I guess one take home is, I think we have some breathing room, some horizon to make some, to look at the situation and do some planning for water supply. So just a quick review, some background, and this is just a review of what I've discussed with the council in the past. And as you know, there's a regional decline in the aquifer we call the Wanapum Aquifer. It's where the city's wells are. Frankly, that's where the bulk of the wells in the region are completed. That decline has been documented for quite a period of time, probably starting about the 1960s, and it really relates back to when the Columbia Basin Project, Irrigation Basin Project, was developed. Some of the infrastructure to deliver surface water wasn't quite developed to the extent it had been planned. To offset that, folks drilled wells, and you developed an ag industry pretty dependent on groundwater supply. That's been taxing to this groundwater system, and frankly, we're removing more out of that aquifer each year than is being naturally recharged. So that is the sort of the situation kind of regionally. In addition to that, the city itself has creates a pumping center, meaning we've got this concentrated set of wells in addition to some of the food processors. That creates kind of an additional kind of seasonal drawdown effect, interference we call that, and that's just exacerbated the problem and thereby shown some reduction in well capacity. So one of the things we looked at beyond just trying to separate out just what is a regional or local pumping effect is those things that are under our control, most specifically is, do we have some well problems themselves? Most of the wells that the city has are what are called open hole. They've been drilled into basalts. They may have some liners, but for the most part, the water is free to enter the boreholes, with one exception. You have this well number 7, and certainly Terry can talk to the details of it, but well number 7 is a well that has well screen, and due to the geochemistry of the aquifer, the water coming into the well over time, it can either build up bacteria or it can actually have chemical precipitation, and it blocks the water from coming into the well, essentially. And that's the case with well number 7. So based on our evaluation, we don't see a well efficiency problem across the board in the existing wells, with the exception of well number 7. And I'll come back to that in greater detail. Just a sense about how severe this decline has been in the aquifer levels. It's actually improving, and that's the good news. It's not improving to the point that it's not going to be a problem in the future, but just to give you a sense of that, just looking at sort of in the region, water levels from about 1960 to about 1980 into the mid-80s were declining at a rate, again, regionally in the Wanapum Aquifer, about 3 feet per year. Starting in about 1985 or so, that increased up to as much as 7 to 8 feet per year, again, regionally, and in some areas as much as 10. The most recent data that we have, just looking at the city's wells themselves, we're now at a decline rate of about 2 feet per year. And you say, well, why the variation? Well, I'll get into that in a little bit more detail, but I think part of the benefits that the city has done is implemented some spreading of its pumping, and I think that alone has reduced some of the interference. So again, and there's some other efforts that are afoot that are going to take a longer time to show any effect, and that is source exchange. The State Department of Ecology, the state has invested in improving and essentially building out some of the surface water infrastructure that was originally intended when the Columbia Basin Project was developed and just was not built. And that what that has done is improved the delivery of surface water, and they're now taking ag off of groundwater. So it's an active source exchange, and over time that should also be sort of bring some relief or moderate that level of decline. What does it mean in terms of the city's kind of actual year-to-year change in capacity? Kind of worst case analysis, we're looking at about a loss of about 200 gallons per minute per year. So that's the collective capacity of the well field. That decline in water levels reduces the pumping capacity of individual wells. And there's some things that can be done to moderate that, but that's what we're looking to address to sustain the level of groundwater development. Just some quick facts about the city's current capacities. This is again with well number six, and as you may or may not know, number six is the one well that has some elevated fluoride. It's addressed through blending. Ideally intended as a standby well, but it is a high capacity well, and it's actually used as part of the system. And then also with bringing well number nine online, the capacity is about 7,500 gallons per minute collective capacity in the well field. Currently, to comply with the Department of Health, which regulates water systems, and Travis was mentioning to me, there's been some discussions with the health department on numbers of connections and whatnot. They have certain criteria in terms of meeting peak demand, meeting fire flow. Their criteria is for the well field to have a peak demand capacity of about 6,000 gallons per minute. So we're current capacity, we're in good shape above that DOH requirement. Obviously, with that decline in capacity that's due to the declining water levels, we begin to eat away at that overall system capacity, but we're looking out probably 7 to 10 years of time frame in which we will be dropping down within the realms of what DOH says is a typical planning number, or 6,000 gallons per minute. One of the points we want to make is this does not mean the city will not be able to meet its water supply needs. There's a lot of flexibility that can be had through storage and shaving off peak with storage. But again, it's just a metric that we aim for in looking at the system's both capacity to reach, to comply with Department of Health, and just overall system sustainability.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
In the previous slide, you indicated that...
This one?
Yeah, there's no indication of lost well efficiency except for well seven. Did you determine that all wells were running at their highest efficiency?
This is how we did that, and there's a memo that I would that has a lot more detail than I can certainly present tonight. So I would suggest that this would be a great source of reference. What we looked at in well efficiency is looking at the pumping capacity, what we call, it's a term called specific capacity. It's the, and I know John, you're familiar with this, gallons per minute per foot of drawdown. And we looked at the gallons per minute per foot of drawdown when the well was installed, okay? And then we also compared it to the most recent pumping data we have when the well is pumping and then when it's shut off. And there's some tolerance there, but for the most part, those efficiencies have remained fairly high. The loss you're seeing in terms of capacity is due to the fact that the available drawdown in the well, the pumping levels are dropping, and the pumps are having to lift, to overcome that greater lift. That's really where we're losing capacity.
Okay, well, all I was thinking about was, are there steps that could be taken, let's say, for instance, well number eight. I don't know what the bowl set's at right now, but could you lower the bowl set, keep more water over the bowl set and continue to operate maybe at 50 to 100 gallons a minute more than what you are currently? By lowering the bowl set and protecting the bowls, putting in a new system that would, monitor it and operate based on a variable speed to control the volume of water over the top of the bowls, rather than turning the pump on and running it at 100% and deadheading it against a clay valve.
Yeah.
Are there things that could be done with the infrastructure of the wells that could possibly maximize, if you picked up 50 to 100 gallons a minute per well, and there's nine of them, you're talking 900 gallons a minute increase in capacity.
Yeah, so, and let me just clarify, you're correct. Then there's a couple categories of actions that can be taken. First and foremost, we're looking at the well itself. So take away the pump for a minute and just think about the well. We want to look first and foremost at is the well itself lost its ability to convey water?
No question.
That's really what I'm speaking for.
There's a sustainability within the hole.
All right, so that's step number one. I want to say of all
the
wells.
Are we optimizing the sustainability of that hole?
Right, so
the information that you've gathered, can you determine that we've optimized that with what we're producing today?
Right, so I'll answer that question. So just with regard to the well construction themselves, only well number 7 is the one that could benefit from well itself rehabilitation, that is cleaning of the well to restore its flow capacity, okay? The other wells, there's nothing that can be done that we believe to the well bore itself. Now, when you turn to pumps, as your water level declines, okay, you change the pump curve, if you will, and I would agree with you that as the water levels decline, there are changes to either the pump, the motors, or how different pumps are designed to operate under different lift conditions. And so, yes, that is a separate category, but certainly from an infrastructure standpoint, I don't know that lowering the bowl typically helps a lot, but certainly changing how some of these pumps are operated and potentially changing out the pumps can affect not only your energy consumption, but your performance of the well. But I guess first and foremost, what we were trying to get at is there a need for well rehabilitation? And the answer is no, with the exception of 7. And in that one, and I'll show it in a minute, we're looking at a minimum with rehabilitation of gaining probably 300 gallons per minute or more. So I would just say that from a cost perspective, you often, from our experience, you first look at can you improve the well itself and gain some appreciable improvement. With infrastructure changing out pumps, it can be done, it just can be pretty costly for possibly small incremental benefits in capacity. Does that answer your question, John?
Good one.
Okay. All right. And I would just ask, there's a lot more detail in here, and I'd be happy to get into it. I just, we've kind of gone well by well, discussion and the data.
And wait, that memo was made available.
You guys have that memo on your board docs. So.
Okay. Any other question? I'll stop right
there. I have a question. So by widening the canal here that has been happening for the last couple of years, I believe it's going into all the way into Connell. If the farmers start pumping from the canal versus well water, what's that going to do to the aquifer level in the
improve
next
it.
10 years?
Improve it. I would just caution that I don't think it'll be a market improvement. It
will be enough?
No, I think it'll moderate.
It'll help.
It'll help, and I want to be
a lot of water.
As I've pointed out, I think we're already seeing some benefits. Certainly, the benefits we're seeing in Othello are more due to what the city and, frankly, the industries around here are doing in terms of spreading the pumping. That's having a notable effect. That's why it's gone from as much as 7 feet per year down to 2, and I think that's an important strategy. I do think over the next decades, and it will take decades, we will see a moderation, that is a reduction in the decline, as ag switches to surface water and comes off of groundwater. I mean, simply put, we're extracting more out of that groundwater system regionally than it's going in. It's just that simple. And it's going to take a long time, and it's a big system, so it's going to take a long time to see any appreciable benefit. But,
yeah. That water's 10,000 years old.
It's very old. Yeah,
it's taken a long time to get there. But what it'll do is, if no longer they're not withdrawing it, it'll sustain.
It'll sustain.
It'll.
So I would say some of the real positive things the city has done. First is spreading pumping of the existing sources. That's probably been the most important benefit of just managing the pumping so that we're not overstressing individual wells. Instead, we're moderating and pumping at lower levels across all wells, and that sustains that pumping level. And as John said, I think that also sustains your capacity per well. So there's a lot to be gained just by how we operate, what wells we choose. Secondly, and probably equally important, is bringing more distant sources online. McCain Foods brought what they call well number 4 on, which is far west side of town. The city has brought number nine far east side of town. It's basically, again, just spreading out the pumping, all in the same aquifer, but it's distributed. And I think that's really what's the main reason we're seeing the moderating of declines. But that isn't enough. We're continuing to lose capacity over time, as I said, over the 7 to 10 year horizon, such that I think we do need to be looking at bringing on another groundwater source. And that's what I want to turn the attention to. We've talked a little bit about well number seven. Just to give you a sense of what that decline is, there's just the more details on it. The well went in back in 1998. At the time, it was about 1,200 gallons per minute. As of last year, we're down about half that, about 600 gallons per minute. And our view would be if the well were rehabilitated, that means pulling the pump, that means cleaning it, reconditioning the screen of the well, then I think we can see some market improvement and gain in terms of reestablishing some of that pumping capacity at a fairly modest cost.
Tim, when you talk about the screen, are you talking about, is there actually a...
There's actually a screen.
Okay.
And that's rare.
Is it black iron or stainless?
It's stainless.
Okay.
Is that correct? I think it's stainless. Yeah. It's stainless, yeah.
Would you recommend sonar jetting that too?
Actually, I think that what I would recommend with that, and I know there are a number of contractors out there, and I know the city's work with Schneider, but I would advise chatting, you know, having a video done, pulling the pump, having a video done, and then assessing whether it be a combination of physical
brushing, swabbing,
possible acid treatment. There's a number of techniques, but I would frankly advise that be done based on the video and specific to the condition. So that's again, I think that's a near-term thing that can be accomplished to bolster and reestablish some pumping capacity. But planning ahead for an additional source, and this takes some consideration. We've looked at a number of options that I'd like to speak to. The two that there's a lot more discussion in our memo, but the two that we've come down to that we feel warrant consideration, and these would be locations that again would stay with trying to spread the pumping outside the city, would be either an additional well near well number nine, which would be the east side of town. The city owns that land. It's invested a lot in conveyance, so there's certainly some value in trying to make use of that location. Or secondly, again, on the extremes of town, more on the west side of town, is the water district, Adams County Water District number one. There's a location there, and it also has some benefits. So we go into a lot more detail in our memo. The value of that location is that it may address some water supply issues in that area. And it's possible there may be some funding options with the Department of Health in terms of consolidating water systems. So the big question, though, aside from location, is what aquifer?
Yep.
Right? We're entirely focused, right now we're entirely developing in the Wanapum. There's been discussions about the Grand Ron. These are certainly both options. And I'd like to just spend a minute on that topic. The Wanapum is... out here, the salts are very thick. The uppermost zone is actually called the Saddle Mountain. In many cases, folks may have heard that there's lots of water shallow. And the fact is, that's true. A lot of the open canals here leak. They leak into what we call the Saddle Mountain basalts. But in that layer of basalts, transitioning from what's called the Saddle Mountain into the Wanapum, there's some pretty competent, solid, massive basalt layers that don't transmit water down. So that water is, you might even call it perched. It's fairly shallow, and it's also most susceptible to having nutrients from ag in the area. So typically it's not used for water supply. It could be, it would likely need to be treated, okay? The second basalt zone is called the Wanapum. That's where we've developed in, and it's typically down to about 1,000, let's say 1,200 feet. That zone is well defined, of course, but there's a lot of users competing for that zone, and as a result of a lot of users, it's depleted over time. And then below that is the Grand Ronde, and that one is not well-defined. I guess outside the region, it certainly has been used for water supply. There's been some exploration into the Grand Ronde, and I won't get into the details on it, but we still don't have a good sense about what kind of yield we might obtain from the Grand Ronde, and more importantly, what the water quality is like. But it's a commitment. It's probably down, we're talking depths of the top of the Grand Ronde is about 1,200 feet, and it would require going as deep as 2,000 feet. There are wells in the region to the northwest and specifically, and then to the east that tap the Grand Ronde. And one of the things that we're recommending is to basically look, rather than just launching into that, to see if we can't get information from these existing wells to get a better handle on what kind of yield might be available and what the water quality is like. It's not easy to get that information. These are private ag wells, but that could certainly provide some information to inform a decision. In terms of these two locations, and in our memo we talk about some options. The first option we looked at is just installing an additional well in the Wanapum. At the well number 9 site, certainly it has the benefit, as I mentioned earlier, of owning the property, you've got conveyance. The issue there is back to something I referred to earlier, which is well interference. When you put wells in close proximity, pumping of one impacts the pumping capacity of the other. So our memo goes into a lot of detail. Essentially, our recommendation is that to locate a new Wanapum well on the east side of town, we would recommend that well have to be outside that 13-acre parcel. For the simple reason is, you just will not get, these wells are typically about 1,500 gallon per minute capacity. If you were to install it within that 13 acres, you would end up with two wells with lower than 1,500 gallon per minute capacity. Essentially, they would impact each other, okay? And if, we would suggest at least a mile out, if not more, and now we're looking at some conveyance costs. So those are some of the considerations in looking at an additional Wanapum well to the east. To the west, the Takaris property, again, we have some wells nearby, not nearly the situation we have in number 9. There are some system improvements that we had there. So, you know, that is certainly a viable location to consider another Wanapum well. Collectively, you know, we have an aquifer system that is declining, so it's certainly not a long-term source, but it certainly could provide, over this timing horizon, some additional capacity.
One thing, Tim, just the council, the city actually has a piece of property that we have been needing to use in DeGaris Park. That's about an acre. When DeGaris Park was developed, they deemed the city for the oil, about an acre. So that's what Jim's talking about. That's why I guess it's DeGaris Park, because you wonder why there. That's why.
Yeah, and obviously one of the other thoughts is, again, if to the extent we can get away from the town center, that provides some benefit in terms of locations. In terms of looking at the Grand Ronde, that's really more of an exploratory option. The most cost-effective manner for exploring the Grand Ronde would be to use an existing well. All the wells go down 1,000 feet into the water pump. You can basically drill a test pilot through an existing well and look deep. We might be looking at going 500 or greater depths into the Grand Ronde to identify a viable zone that's of decent water quality. When the city drilled number 9, I think you went an additional about 200 feet or so into the Grand Ronde. Unfortunately, water quality samples were not taken, but there was indication of water supply at that depth. My sense is we probably end up going beyond that to verify yield capacity to justify a production well and to get water quality. So in our memo, I won't get into all the details. We present a series of options, both exploratory, strictly exploratory, that is drilling at a location from ground surface down, or using an existing well and the cost associated with those options. The benefit of a Grand Ronde well, at least in the east side of town, would be that it could be sited adjoining well number nine. We do not anticipate any well interference from having a Grand Ron well at that location. The infrastructure is there. Even if we had a potentially elevated fluoride issue, it could be blended with well number nine. So certainly from a supply standpoint, albeit there's risks, but if it were successful, that location would be an ideal location for that. And lastly, as I mentioned, some of the steps, I feel that it would be prudent to reach out, if possible, to some of the their commercial ag operations, to Terrace, to vegetarians. All have some wells that are deep enough. That information is just not publicly available, so it's going to require making direct contact with them.
So I got a question. On our well number six, we plugged part of that.
Yeah.
Weren't they telling us that that was in the Grand Run?
Well number six is not complete in the Grand Run. It's a one of them.
Well
no,
well six.
Well six was a Grand Run well. Oh, and they plugged it.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
I don't think it was never a Grand Ron well. It was in between.
That's what we were told.
How much did you?
I was on the city council when we drilled into the Grand Ron, and ecology came down on us because we were mixing aquifers, and they forced us to plug it and go back up into the one of them. And that was like 20 some years ago.
Yeah, my understanding is, fluoride is oftentimes introduced in between the actual rock layers. You have interbeds, they're organic layers, and oftentimes that's where you end up introducing fluoride. And my understanding, we weren't involved, but is that the work that was done was to try to isolate what zone in the borehole was contributing fluoride and seal it off. Now, it may well be that when the well was originally drilled, it went into the Grand Ron and then was backed up and plugged. That may have been the case, but the fluoride, as I understood it, was an attempt to try to rehabilitate that existing well. Is that consistent, or am I wrong with that?
It's fine.
It doesn't matter.
No, right now it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fluoride is something that we're concerned about and need to be worried about. On the other hand, if there's an opportunity to blend, I think that can be addressed. And I think one of the points about whether we drill Guanacom or Grand Ron is a conversation. Once staff has had a chance to look at our memo, we've provided quite a bit of discussion in there about the pros and cons of either choice. As I mentioned, we have some planning horizon, I think, to consider those options. Honestly, from the standpoint of there's certainly it's an unknown, and if the city were to identify that in fact the Grand Ron were viable, the benefit of it is not being used, and so that could be that's a positive thing from the standpoint of knowing that it's not going to be depleted as quickly as the Wanapum, but it's a costly option to look at.
So then, can I ask a question? If we were to decide, rather than drill a brand new well into the Grand Ron, and we were going to, because you had mentioned it earlier, take an existing well that's in the Wanapum and drill further into the Grand Ron, which would certainly already has a conveyance, it already has already been drilled to a certain depth, which would be certainly more cost effective if it works,
right.
which well would you recommend that we drill?
We have some discussion about that. One of the answer to that question is has two parts to it. One would be, what can you afford to bring offline in terms of capacity? But secondly, we need to know whether the wells are plumb, whether they're a vertical. They're deep wells. If you have a 1,000-foot deep well and it's got a slight angle
curvature,
to it, it's not going to be a candidate for drilling deeper. And so that's one of the unknowns that we need to address, is has there historically been plumb tests done, and that would help us isolate what are even candidates to do it. Because you have to run a drill stem through that 1,000 feet. That's one constraint. But it would really, it could actually be any of the wells, and I would choose it both on the first being Plum, and then secondly, what can the city afford in terms of bringing offline. I don't anticipate that the conditions over the scale of the city, doesn't matter west side, east side, within the scale of the city, that we do that exploration. I think it would be, any of the wells could be a viable candidate to do that.
Provided they meet the criteria.
Provided they would allow us to drill beyond, right.
Okay.
And we give some cost estimates on that option, as well as just drilling from ground surface, and potentially completing a Wannapum well. That's the other option. You can drill a test well and then ream it out and end up with a Wannapum well. But there's some cost implications and siting implications. And I'll leave the details there in our memo. So I guess in the long short of it all, in the short-term strategies, we're recommending we have about a five-year planning horizon looking at the what is now, I'd say, a moderate decline in the system and the city's water supply capacity to plan for an additional source. That could be the exploratory drilling and or siting of a Wannapum well. I think during that time, we would certainly recommend the rehab happen to reestablish that capacity as well. And then beyond that, looking at the future or longer-term plans, as Justin indicated, looking at multiple surface water sources. The city has already had some conversations with Bureau of Reclamation. Of course, that water would be seasonal. The benefit of that is that the treatment costs likely for that, using that water, would be lower, and it could be used directly as a potable supply. Alternatively, reclaimed water, industrial wastewater, a year-round supply, potentially a larger quantity. You don't have to pay for it. But it may come with a cost of higher treatment. So those are really an economics analysis that needs to be done to look at. In either case, the next topic I want to talk about is aquifer storage and recovery. I think ASR, which is the acronym, dovetails nicely with any surface water source. It allows you, I guess the key thing is it allows you to use that treatment capacity to store water when the city's demand is low. That's essentially what that allows you to do, as well as the city has invested a lot in a groundwater infrastructure. You've got a lot of wells, you have a piping system, you have a treatment system. ASR allows you, in a depleting aquifer situation, to continue to use that infrastructure. And I think that's an important factor for the city of Othello. So I'm going to walk through just some background on aquifer storage and recovery. And then I'm going to have Andrew talk specifically about our scope of this grant that we currently have with the Department of Ecology. But before I do, is there any other questions on the source evaluation that I can answer before we kind of change gears and talk about aquifer storage?
Just want to add one thing, Tim, that going to what Jesse had talked about water rights. You notice that some of our limitations based on water rights. With the ASR, especially if we get that canal, we get some, what do you call it, John, industrial?
Municipal and industrial water.
M&I. We pay for them, but they'll give us basically what we need up to, you know, I don't know how much. So that's what's driving this part, too, is that, you know, so why don't we just keep drilling wells? That's well and good. But if we can't acquire the water rights, then if you drill another 10 wells out there, if we're going out, wherever we go, if we're out of water rights, we hit that ceiling that Jesse talked about. Just keep that in mind, as, you know, as he talks, Tim talks all about cost and complexity of this. That's why we're looking at this piece right here, too.
Yeah, that's a good point, Wade. What I've been speaking about in terms of additional groundwater sources is just essentially maintaining the capacity to pump the amount of water that's equal to your water rights, because over time, if your well capacity, then how much the flow rate that you can get the gallons per minute out of the well continues to decline, you essentially don't have, you're not enjoying the benefit of your full water rate. So that's really what we've been talking about. The surface water treatment, the aquifer storage and recovery allows us to bump up and have access to additional water above and beyond the groundwater rights. So, pretty simple concept, and we've talked about it, for aquifer storage and recovery, essentially divert or accept from, let's say, retained water, a source, Bureau Reclamation or industrial wastewater. You inject it through either one of the city's existing water supply wells or a well that's strictly dedicated to aquifer storage or recovery. You store it in that aquifer. We've got a depleted system. It makes a fairly ideal vessel, meaning there's lots of storage capacity in the one of them. And then you recover that water. And typically, in many situations, injection occurs in periods of time when water is available, oftentimes in the winter. A little different for the city of Othello, right? You'd be, if you went the route of your reclamation, that's M&I water available during the irrigation season. So again, you may operate depending on what the source waters allows. As I mentioned earlier, if it's industrial wastewater, that's a year-round supply. So we could essentially have an injection system year-round and then recovery on certain wells. So it's more of a year-round operation. Objectives for aquifer storage and recovery vary a lot in the state or in the Northwest. Everything from a real common one is retiming the hydrograph, meaning in areas that I do work, for example, in the city of White Salmon, they have a surface water source. They're very dependent on snowpack melt, and when it's gone, it's gone. So if they have hot early springs, gets warm, the snow melts, they need to capture that water and store it. And that's a real common thing. Not so much an issue for the city of Othello. Drought certainly is a situation. Probably in your case, and we've highlighted here, of course, is offsetting depletion. We're essentially going to use that aquifer as a reservoir. It's just the nature's not replenishing it as quickly as it's being taken out.
Can I just throw one thing out there? One consideration that I didn't see is that there's an abundance of water that's perking, as you said, at the 300 to 500 foot level, probably 3,000 to 4,000 gallons a minute, you know, depending on what you wanted for a hole. That is totally sustainable. That's not tied to the canal. That's not tied to anything. So if you're going to look at a long-term source of water now, you wouldn't take that and use it immediately, but if you treated it, it's treatable water that could be recharged into an aquifer ARS. I mean, and so basically you'd be lifting it from 300 feet, yeah, putting it through a treatment plant, and then sending it back down to 800 to 1,000 feet, and then using it from there.
And you're talking about, like, what I was talking about, the water in the Saddle Mountain, the uppermost zone, yeah.
Yeah, the water that's east of the canal, or, I mean, west of the canal, I mean, it's abundant.
Yeah.
As you know, yeah, there's 3,000 to 4,000 gallons a minute at 300 feet, and it's not going to go away because all that water is perked on top of that, yeah, solid basalt layer that it's not percolating through. So that's there. And I know the Bureau is going after people and saying, that's our water. We created that water. We want to sell it. You know, so if you drill a well in there, there's a possibility they would come after you to pay for it. But it's not tied to a flow of water, surface water, that the canal would have to provide. It's there.
Yeah, no, John, you're correct, and that's being looked at. But you're also correct that the Bureau of Reclamation's position right now is that shallow groundwater, even it may be miles away from their canal system, they are still claiming that's commingled with water that they recharged from their surface canal system, and you essentially seek a permit from Bureau of Reclamation. You are correct, though. There's quite a bit of water. It is shallow. It still has costs associated with, you know, withdrawing it, treating it, and the like. So I guess, that, again, it's really an economics analysis. But
it's an alternative to using a surface water source.
It is an alternative. I would say that you would, under what I can see today, is that you'd still end up securing a permit from Bureau of Reclamation, and there's costs with that. So it's really a cost question.
Yeah. Well, if you get municipal and industrial water from the Bureau, you're going to pay for that.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know if they've worked out the costs yet on what they think their water is worth at 300 feet versus delivering it to you through a canal system.
Right.
I mean, because basically the water ended up there from the canal system, but yet they're not actually conveying it to you. You're going out and getting it, so the cost associated with that, they haven't determined it yet.
Yeah, it's just there's a permitting process, and that permitting process at the present time is very uncertain in terms of your access, legal access to that water. But you're right, it's certainly, I would anticipate in the decades to come, that can't be ignored, that quantity of water. Anyway, there are other reasons for objectives. I think we're clear on ours. It's really looking at a means to develop a source and address this depletion. I've gone through clearly some of the declines that have led to that depletion and why we would use ASR as a means to essentially offset some of that. Just going to move through these quickly. The question came up earlier about, and it was a good observation, with aquifer storage, the regulations that guide injection of water are actually more stringent than drinking water, and it's this anti-degradation. Essentially, what it says is that you have to protect the groundwater to its background levels. So even if there are constituents in the groundwater, like manganese, for example, which, you know, it's the thing that turns your appliances orange, but it's really not a health issue. And you're proposing to put in water that is higher manganese than what the aquifer has, that's regulated. So that's why that happens. There's a series of regulations, and I put this out there because these also guide the permitting of aquifer storage. That's our grant is really geared towards addressing these specific issues. The last one on here is an important one. The state is now recognizing reclaimed water for aquifer storage. And that's important. Several of us went to a water reuse conference, and I think we're moving to in a positive direction to allowing reclaimed water to be recharged into the aquifer and then pulled out and put into the potable system. And I think that's going to be a positive step towards using what is a large quantity of water in this region. Just to give you a sense, there's probably maybe 15 aquifer storage and recovery projects in the state of Washington. There's talk about City of Quincy, City of Moses Lake, developing ASR. Many of these projects, like Othello, are in the early stages of feasibility study, but there are a few examples where they're proven technology. On the small scale, City of White Salmon will have an operating system probably by the end of this year. They're more in the 200 acre feet, or I guess let me say 300 acre feet, which is roughly 1 million gallons a year of storage. No, that's not quite right. But I know this group is familiar with 1 million gallons. Acre feet is a metric that we tend to use. But let's just put it this way: for the City of White Salmon, they store about 25% of their need of their annual supply. For their system. Contrast that, the City of White Salmon, they're storing probably, six times that quantity, much larger scale. And I would anticipate, I've got another slide, the city, depending on the source, could be at the upper end of the storage quantities. Some of the options, we've already had some conversations with, as I mentioned, Bay Reclamation and with the irrigation district in terms of where water would come from, and also consideration of looking at which wells might be ideal, existing wells for ASR. Right now, some of the prior work that was done by the Guama was suggesting well number 6. Our preference, again, we just started about a month ago, is actually wells 2 or 3. And the reason is they're very central. It may allow us to recapture some of that injection water out of a more than one well. So that's just some initial thoughts. Our starting point for this work was really some work previously done under funding from the state. It was done by the groundwater management area. They had developed a model of the entire Wanaquam area. And our work is really looking at characterizing both your specific infrastructure for adapting to ASR and then looking at scale. With the Bureau of Reclamation, that's going to be seasonal water. We're probably looking on the tune, as I mentioned, probably more on the White Salmon scale, 500 acre feet or so in quantity. If it's reclaimed water, it may be a year-round injection, and we could be looking at a significantly greater quantity. You know, basically, 50% of the city's current supply could be an ASR. I'm going to turn this over to Andrew to just kind of talk through the scope, but just to introduce it. The funding is from the state. It's off Columbia River. Their mission is to develop new storage or new supplies in the state of Washington. Our feasibility study is aligned to answer a lot of the questions that are required to get a permit, and they look at these various steps, both the technical operational constraints, that's kind of the groundwater system, the legal and environmental requirements, and then lastly, the cost considerations associated with actually operating a system. I think I'm going to turn it now over to you, and Andrew's just going to run through that scope, and then we'll wrap up on the ASR.
Evening, everyone. Yeah, we'll keep it pretty brief for the most part. Just kind of a 5,000-foot view of the feasibility assessment. I know we're constrained on time a bit. But yeah, just to back up very briefly, what Tim said, 180K grant off of Columbia River. And the purpose of the feasibility study is essentially to look at the concept as a whole and try and basically poke holes into it to see if the case holds water, in addition to answering all of the requirements of the series of WACs that Tim outlined earlier. So we've developed a pretty aggressive set schedule, in large part because there are some uncertainties associated with the potential surface water sources of the canal or the irrigation districts. We want to get out and get some water quality samples while they're up and running. So jumping off the bat, we're going to assess basically all the data that we have so far: water level, flow, water quality data for groundwater, surface water, and determine where those holes are. And because this is funded through the Department of Ecology and because we want to collect the best data possible, we'll be developing a quality assurance project plan, or QAP, for submission to Ecology, just basically saying how we're going to collect everything, the purpose of it, and what the best way is to collect the best data. And then go out and get it. So we're planning to have that wrapped up by September of 2016. And then again, moving into the legal framework, which will be done on a similar time scale in September. And what Tim was alluding to is that it's largely the reservoir permit is what Ecology issues associated with ASR programs that really give you the green light. So in this case, the ASR is an underground reservoir, Wanapum Basalt Aquifer, or the Grand Ron, potentially. So really addressing those WAC requirements to be able to obtain a reservoir permit. And again, we'll get to that point by September of this year. And then immediately following those two pathways is the fatal flaw and treatment assessment. So this is kind of a critical turning point in determining whether or not the project moves forward, go, no go, are there any linchpins that aren't in place, that sort of thing. So again, really heavily weighted toward the fall of the year, in large part because we need to get out and get as much data as possible while we have the opportunity. And then the meat of it is essentially the feasibility report. Draft will be out in February of this coming year, both to the city and to Ecology, finalizing that in spring of next year. And that'll tackle the big meaty stuff and directed largely towards answering the questions that are needed to provide the permits. So that'll, again, the hydrogeologic conceptual model, how much water can the aquifer store, how easily can we get it in, how long can we store it, what's the recoverability of that water, the really critical questions in terms of moving forward with an operational ASR program. And then the conceptual operation and pilot test plan. So at full-scale operation, what would the system look like? How would it be operated? Really the big picture view and in terms of what levers need to be pulled and that sort of thing to keep the plan up and running. And then also developing a pilot test plan. So after coming up with a conceptual operation plan, what are the questions that we can answer with a pilot testing program and how are we going to go about implementing that program? And again, May of 2017 is the goal. So this work is intended to be wrapped up by June of next year in its entirety, at least in terms of this scope. And this second bullet, the conceptual operation and pilot test plan, that terminates the scope of the feasibility assessment or the feasibility study. But obviously, if all the lights are green and things are looking like they're on a good trajectory, we want to continue the planning phase and set some kind of preliminary dates for the city to continue to move forward if that is the path that they choose and the feasibility assessment agrees with. So again, by fall of winter of 2017, so a year from this coming fall, potentially be able to do some wellhead and conveyance modifications to allow injection. So basically a small-scale pilot test in line with the plan that we develop immediately following the conceptual operation plan. And then even looking out further, some point in 2018, if, again, assuming all things go well, after making some of those modifications, doing a smaller scale system shakedown pilot testing. So this wouldn't involve water with a treatment facility in place or using surface water from the canal, but instead, after modifying a wellhead or two to be able to send water down the hole as opposed to taking it out, we would go ahead and use distribution system water to really look at the physical properties of the aquifer. So nothing in terms of chemical compatibility, but really just seeing how well it would perform in terms of getting water into the ground, storing it, and getting it out. So that's kind of the shakedown of this current scope and kind of the path forward that we would take. And I caught the tail end, but we're short on time, so.
Can I conclude by, Allstate River has at least tentatively committed to funding the pilot test. I think there's great confidence that this is going to be successful. Obviously, we need to prove that out. Part of the reason for our aggressive schedule is their funding cycle. They run a July 1 to June 30th, and June 30th of 2016, actually June 30th of 2017 ends their current biennium, and we already have a placeholder, City of Othello has a placeholder for the pilot test, so that's our aim, is to be in a position to continue that funding and roll forward. Any questions? Go ahead, John.
Can you kind of give a basic description of what the injection system looks like? Does it increase the pressure on the zone? Are you actually having to force, using energy to force the water into the hole? And what does that do to the transmissivity of the water movement through the basalt?
Yeah, the aquifers that we're injecting in are confined aquifers. So yes, you are injecting in, I wouldn't call it excessive pressure because the statics on those things are already fairly low. And you are injecting, but you are pressurizing or injecting into the system and displacing some of that native water and creating a bulb, which you then recover.
So part of the problem today with the availability of water in the holes, you know, is the fact that they're no longer pressurized, that the water's not moving to those holes. So when you shut them off, it's just a gradual recharge to the static level. So by doing injection, you're increasing the pressure in the zone, which would actually move water to the wells that are actually taking water.
Yeah, one other thing, good point. Some of the wells, and when you depressurize over time, dewater really, these basalts, you're actually dewatering like individual flow zones. And that's why some of the wells end up having actually cascading water in. That's an important consideration in terms of where are we targeting the injection of water. It may not be through the whole horizon. It may require us sealing off some of those zones so that we are pressurizing a specific zone, not eight zones over the course of, 500 feet. So that's part of what we need to do, is isolate the zone that we're actually doing storage in, as opposed to just injecting across the entire system. But I agree with you. Some of those zones have been essentially dewatered.
So your suggestion of keeping it close and using well number two, which is not producing at all right now today, you know, keeping it close into town and where the other wells could pick it up more readily because they're closer.
Yeah,
in
many cases, in the city of White Salmon, we actually put in a well design for monitoring, but we're using an existing well that has lost its capacity. But our intent is to inject and withdraw from the same single point. It's a pretty small system. In a larger system, there's operational benefits of being able to extract from multiple wells, inject in one and withdraw from others. So that's frankly what we're looking at, because I think we have the luxury of that here. Any other questions?
Yeah, I've got a question.
Yes.
We're looking at the possible pilot testing in 2018. So how long after that do you think, if that was successful, that we would be into the next biennium for building?
Yeah, let's see. The pilot testing funds would occur in the next biennium, which begins July 1st, 2017 through June 30th, 2019.
19, that's what I'm asking. Would we probably be into the next one?
Yeah, and as what Andrew indicated was an important point, to operate an ASR system, we're going to need a source that's treated. That's a key component here, is to first look at the economics of treating Bureau of Reclamation water, which has to be purchased and is seasonally available, or doing reclaimed water and the scales of those, and then seeking funding and construction of surface water treatment, that being the source. So those are all need to be added to the timeline to look at when might we have an operating ASR system. I think, is that what you're getting, maybe getting
yeah,
at?
I was By the time you get the pilot testing done, would be into the second biennium.
Yeah, I think you're right. Correct.
For building the treatment and ASR.
We will, as we've discussed with staff, we will be looking at, we and RLA will be looking at alternative funding sources for treatment, the water treatment component of the project. OCR is supporting the, you might say, the reservoir side, the aquifer side. The treatment side will have to be sought through other funding sources. Any other questions? Thank you. I know we took quite a bit of time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, let me just add a couple of things to what Jim said. First of all, the timeline for this ASR thing, we may have said this before, but correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but other communities have taken 7, 8, 9 years from start to concept to pumping water. White salmon, it took how long?
I guess we're like 3 years, 4 years, 4 years.
Yeah.
And that's fast, though.
That was fast.
White salmon is actually quite fast. City of Walla Walla is still working on a permit. City of Yakima is still working on a permit.
Right.
These things take a long time.
Right. So that's important. That's why Jim alluded to the phased approach to this is, you know, we've done all the studies. We've, you know, studied out here. And so we know we have to get some long-term water. And just to give you a reason why I'm so passionate about this, so about a year or two ago, a couple of years ago, one of the most distinguished senior citizens, I can't recall his name, met me at function, looked me in the eye and said, "Don't run us out of water." Okay. So I took that as a charge. Of course, last summer we almost did, and I was going, gosh, I'm going to, you know, not live up to his expectation. But water is number one priority for the city. You guys recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news is we've put money back, and Spencer and I will be talking about water rate setting based on future infrastructure and stuff here soon. About that'll cover things like this. So we've always put money back for, not always, but for many years, put money back for wells. Tim alluded to the fact we'll have to have a system to treat this. Well, guess what? The money we put back for wells won't be needed anymore. We'll use that money to run the plant, buy the water from the irrigation district if we have to, or the OCR, whoever sells it from, and that sort of thing. So as we're looking long term, you know, we got short term fix that Jesse alluded to. That's for the well side. You'll have to. I originally thought a year or two ago I didn't want to spend another dime of the city's money on another well, but we're going to have to, just to meet the demand signal that we're having. Midterm, maybe the wastewater plant, you know, redoing that if that works, or working towards the ASR thing. And that's what we'll look at next. And so along the way, each of these steps that we're looking at requires a lot of stuff. It requires buy-in from the regulatory agencies, buy-in from the funding agencies, and of course buy-in from the city and what we're doing. Our goal is to spend, and I think Tim may have alluded to this, is to spend as little of the city's money as possible until we absolutely have to. And that's, you know, that's what Tim and Jesse and those guys are really good at, is helping us go out and look for those grants. And we've made a lot of good contacts in the last year between Sean and myself and of course, Tim and other guys have talked to those regulatory agencies and the funding agencies, and they are excited about the fact that Othello has a plan and not just going out and saying, "Oh, we got to drill another well. Oh, we're going to do this." We have a real plan. So that's what we're working towards. And so that's why I wanted these guys to come in and give you guys an update on what all this is involved. So as citizens, see what's going on and ask questions, you guys can answer them. So that's the idea.
Hey, thank you, Wade.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim, Andrew, Jesse. Okay, let's move to 2.03, latecomer agreement explanation. There was discussion at our last council meeting, and Travis, I believe you have prepared some information for us.
I'm wondering if you maybe want me to switch to the next one since it's kind of on topic of that, or do you want to keep this order?
Council, are you okay with him going to 204 and then coming back to 203?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. Thank you.
So, I am going to talk a little less about the planning side and a little more of the practical day-to-day. And based upon some of the conversations that we've had and the fact that Well 9 is now online, I gave a call to Andy Cervantes at the Department of Health and was asking him questions about, okay, how many connections do we have on our existing system and what's our current approved capacity? And so I put together a quick agenda memo, and the answers to that is the connection limit that they've given for the city, and that's 3,142, and our current approved connections is 2,926. Now, the one quirk about the way the Department of Health does this, and they talk about connections. So, for example, the Guadalupe Haven has 9 buildings, so there are 9 connections, although we know that there are 96 units in that development. So what the professionals in the field and what the planners and engineers tend to talk about is ERUs, equivalent residential units, meaning the equivalent of a single-family residence, how many is it going to use. So in this case, the equivalent residential units for Guadalupe Haven would be 96, even though the connections that the Department of Health counts is 9, based upon there's 9 buildings that are connected to the system. So in some cases, we're talking about apples and oranges, but for some reason, it seems to work, and that's the metrics that they use.
So what's 207 represent?
Or the 216?
No, the 207.
You didn't
title your...
Oh, okay, yeah, sorry. So theoretically, what we have is a remaining capacity of 216 connections. That does not include Well 9.
Oh, so that's a countdown.
Yes, so not including Well 9, exactly, that's a countdown. So Guadalupe Haven, 9 connections, which means that 216 becomes 207. And then counting down, so the more units or the more connections that have been approved. And the reason why I separated these out is because under Washington state law, first in means first vested. So all of these units which have applications in and approvals that are given, they are vested based upon the order of, so if we had a new development come in and they did 200 units, they wouldn't necessarily get all 200 of those connections, because if we only have, in this case, 121 yet, they could do 121 units based upon their order of vesting. On the other hand, once we run out, we theoretically run out, and we would have to start turning away building permits based upon who's got the most senior rights based upon their vesting.
So okay, just backtrack 1 minute.
Okay.
We came to the conclusion that there's 3,142 connection limits. There's, what's the criteria for the approved connections from the Department of Health?
So those theoretically are not based upon the Department of Health. Those are theoretically the rate payers that Bonnie could print a list of all 2,000 people who pay a bill. And it includes some people out in Water District Number 1 and some of our independent contracts.
So those are existing users at this
point? Yes. Theoretically, you could also call them existing users, but Department of Health would freak out because not all of them are users or defined, how do you define that? So
the 3,142 Department of Health connections. That's based on the system capacity at the current time, right now?
Yes.
And it's excluding well number 9?
Which is why they still need to do the analysis to figure out, okay, how much is well 9 producing, therefore, how many equivalent residential units, which means how many potential connections. So you might get, you know, 380 connections, but you might have the equivalent of 580 residential units. But they're assuming there's going to be some commercials that use more, and there's going to be, you know, some residences and different types of uses. So it's not a perfect science, and probably we have the experts here to help us with that. I'm just going on the simple primer of letting you know that we have this defined capacity that the state sees as connections, and we have a bunch of people in line to get those connections. And then the next page, you see these are all the people who are talking to me about potential projects, and they're already kind of putting us into the red based upon whoever's first in the door gets in line first. So, you know, if we get a hotel out at the watering hole, if they're first in line, instead of going to negative 99, we might actually go to 120. And then if Cat Homes comes in, that number would be minus 36, which would put us in the 180. So this is kind of just to give you a rough estimate of, on top of the fact that there are constraints on the physical ability to get the water out of the ground, we have people in line who are lined up to get that water and want to get approvals to get in line for that water. I also point out in here that this is the total number of people who are in line or expect connections based upon their vested land use application. If we are building 100 houses a year, we have 2 years capacity before we even get to needing well 9, and if well 9 buys us 380, that buys us 3.8 more years of 100 units per year worth of growth. And the only reason why I bring this up is, you know, within the next 5 to 6 years, well 9, theoretically within 2 years, you know, well 9's capacity will also be set aside for people who are in the queue invested. And the reason why we're bringing it up is kind of, I want you to bear in mind that there is a physical line forming to absorb this water that they're already talking about may or may not be in the ground, and our wells may or may not be able to continue to produce that and solutions for that. So I wanted to let you know that there is kind of a real life demand for the philosophical stuff that they're talking to you about today.
What are you saying? If we get 100 units, 120 units per year, in the next 5 years, we're going to be out of water. 5, 6 years.
Well, we'll be at our capacity.
Top capacity.
Yes, yeah. Unless we do something.
Approved connections. Now, the other thing to bear in mind, and that is, if we were to require low flow, and we were to take irrigation off of our existing system, the Department of Health, so if we were to, say, invest $3 million in an irrigation purple pipe system here in town for vast swaths of our neighborhood, they may say, okay, that buys you an extra 600 units because now instead of using your potable water, you're using M&I water, which means that you just bought yourself 6 more years of breathing room by installing purple pipe.
So how hard is it to get M&I water? I know when I let the M&I water go, the gal up there in Euphrata, she says, you know, think about it, because once you let that go, it's nearly impossible to get it back.
Yes. So again, there is a separate queue or a separate line for people who are in line. M&I water is interruptible, and the word that I've gotten from the irrigation district here, and that is, they have yet to cause an interruption in an interruptible water right to this point. So,
but if you develop a housing development on land that has an existing Bureau of Reclamation water right, no, it was ag use. Mm-hmm. It was an agricultural plot of land that you're now deciding to turn into a housing development. You have, as long as you get that certificate from the previous owner.
Well, as long as you don't let it go, that's what I just said.
You don't let it go. If you have an assessment associated with that land from the East Columbia Basin Irrigation District, maintain that, because then you can take water for irrigation.
Yes. Yes.
And you should, we as a city should be demanding that if those water rights exist on the developmental property, that those need to be exercised for irrigation purposes.
Would you like us to develop?
Yes. And we currently have code that requires anyone who develops with water rights have to turn those over to the city when they develop and connect to our system. What we've run into is the department or the irrigation district has pointed out that really there are two separate lines of people who own water rights. One is the agricultural water rights line, and the other is the M&I line. And what they've said is there's a ton of capacity in the M&I line because nobody's lining up to use it. The agricultural line is not quite full, but it has a lot of people in line, and the age is very important on that line. But what they've pointed out is you can't take a 1960s water right from the ag side and move to the front of the line at the M&I, because all of these are interruptible, whereas the ag is not. So, except for seniority issues. So, in other words, you can't take an old water right and purchase it and move to the front of the line and expect never to be interrupted. Because theoretically, if there's a shortage, they start at the bottom of this line, move to the top, and then they move to the ag and move to the top of that line. So we don't necessarily know whether this is correct, but all of the indications we've got so far is that there are two different lines. One of them has plenty of capacity. We just need to simply make the effort to get in line and start using that water.
We need to research. You need to research the classifications for the use of irrigation water. Because I know that there is different classifications for irrigation water.
Yeah, but to your question, what I want to find out, because I was under a misconception that it felt like in this case, you let it go, Angela, for no reason, but if we developed up north, say, and we had this field up there that's going to be developed, and it had water rights, don't those transfer over to the next owner? And then, I mean, they must, because I'm on irrigation water out where I am. So in the Roberts edition out there,
There's all kinds of subdivisions have irrigation water.
Then to your point about forcing the developer then to use that, why?
I'll tell you this, the project water, the project works because they sell water. So they don't want to be replacing project water with city water that you would get from a groundwater source. They want to sell the water, so they want to keep people irrigating on that piece of ground that they had. Mm-hmm. You know.
So then, okay, council, but what I'm asking then, and what I don't want to get to, is if it's on the books that the developers must use irrigation water if available, that's already on the books, we will, when I watch, see, we hadn't had a chance to enforce that because it's already gone, by the way.
Well,
watch. So if you want us to enforce that, we will. If it's not on the books, then we'll develop the code that says it.
Well, all that Hampton land that's being developed by CBHA has irrigation water rights. And I guarantee you those did not expire, because the Hamptons would never let that happen.
And CBHA is going to use irrigation water for the irrigation.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, they don't expire. The new buyer applies for it again. And then you get the whatever footage, you know, they had.
Acre feet,
that's what you get, right? You know, right off the bat. So you don't lose anything, but you have to reapply for it.
3 acre feet per acre, you know. And what I mean by expire, if you don't pay it in a year, it's gone. Mm-hmm. It can leave by not paying it.
Right. So, okay, just we have clear direction from council then that we are going to enforce what's on the books, if that is on the books. If it's not there, we'll bring you a new code that says make it so.
Yes.
And then in the new development, then
we'll enforce the D&M
property, Garza property, outside of, well, and also, well, what's his name there in the middle, that Olson?
Olson, I think that's, it may be gone because of the time. We'll check on that, but I think it's...
Well, a new development that he's thinking about doing on the lower end.
I don't know, I'll research you by that.
Go ahead and continue. So Jesse actually pointed out that he can give us a little more technical information on the, how they arrive at the connections number and the Department of Health.
So John, one of your first questions was, hey, where does that 3,142 connection limit come from DOH? And they actually get that from the city, and I've prepared a lot of those numbers for other municipalities. And it's basically an analysis of your supply, your storage, your distribution, your water rights. And it's just looking at what your current use is, what your total capacity is. And so you've got these different components, and one of those is the limiting component. So right now, if source capacity was the limiting component for that 3,142, you've now got more than presumably when you did then. You know, the capacities kind of go up and down as the declines occur and you add more wells and everything, but if source is the limiting capacity, that number would probably get bigger. So it's just an analysis that the city does and provides it to DOH. They review it, and if it looks good, then they say, okay, yeah, that's now your official number of connections that you're allowed to have. So right off the bat, an analysis can be done to refresh that number and figure out what the current capacity of your system is. Mm-hmm. And then that translates to time. And if it, you know, if your limiting facility continues to be supply, that also informs the timelines of the water supply expansions that we're talking about. So is that kind of the where your question started there initially?
Good. You got it.
Okay.
And, but I think,
so if he was asking if is storage potentially a factor in there, and yes it is, and it just depends which one of those components is limiting. So if it continued to be source, you would be adding source capacity. If then at some point you cross over, storage is limiting, then that's the next facility you expand.
As we found out last summer, storage is not the limiting capacity. You can have all the storage you want, but as that starts going down and you can't put nothing in it.
Supply, yeah, with a couple of sources down, supply was very limiting.
Yeah. Great. Okay, so get the gist of that. You want to move on to the next one?
Sure.
Great.
Sure. So the second one that I was asked to discuss, I'm sorry I wrote such a long memo. I tried to keep it short, but there were a lot of issues that kind of kept coming to my mind. The first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to clarify that the city code has a couple quirks, and I put together some code changes to take to the Planning Commission this month. The sewer fees, the sewer connection fees, and the water connection fees are, we have four different names for the two, essentially what are two fees. The site facility charge is kind of the cost to hire the guys to go out and do the physical stuff in the ground. And then the general facilities charge is the buying into the system charge. On the sewer side of the house, those are actually called the sewer permit fee is the buy-in. And then they have a connection fee, which is essentially the site facilities fee. So in this case, we have the buy-in fee and then the physical cost recovery fee. And they're called different names in the sewer system and the water system. So I'm proposing language to the Planning Commission. It should come to you in August as the council, for you to call them either the general fee or the site facility fee. So just to clarify that, because in this memo I basically just call them the site facility fee and the general facility fee. So in tying to what we've been talking about, there are facility costs to operate the system, like the wells, the pumps, the towers, the rehab of those things. The general facility fee is essentially paying your fair share to buy into the well system, the storage system, that's already in place. The connection cost is the site to actually go out and put the tap in the water line that's in the street or the well, or, I'm sorry, the main that's in the alley. That's what the site connection fee. And then the actual cost to install that infrastructure is borne by the developer at the time they develop. So those are kind of the three components of fees.
So say that a little more time, because I'm still unclear about that, because
okay,
you're saying here that there's a charge, and the charge is associated for the site facility charge. For example, the cost to cut the street, dig up the pipe, tap into the pipe, install the connection, lay the pipe, and then you turn around and say that's the developer's responsibility?
Yes.
Okay, why are we paying a fee if we're paying for the... Why would a developer pay a fee for the to the city who's charging him for these items, but yet he's going out and hiring a contractor to come in and do all that work and paying for it?
Okay, so I included a private sector example, including this map in the staff report. So let's take the city out of it at this point, so hopefully that'll remove some of the concern. So in this case, when Olson Homes created the Sagestone and the Ashwood Notch subdivisions, there was a missing gap in the infrastructure, and it included 529 feet of sewer line and stormwater line in Gemstone, which is this east-west connector here, and it connects to 7th Avenue. And then there was a missing connection between Gemstone and Columbia Street, and that was 524 feet of missing pipe that was off-site. Now, Pete, when he was developing these, he installed the main in the street and put his connections on those on-site. So in this case, he had to build a missing piece of the puzzle, and that is the only portion in this example where he could do a latecomers, because he's not responsible for building this, but at this point, unless that line was built, he couldn't move forward. So in other words, it was the roadblock for him doing any development was that missing piece. So in this case, he had to decide, do I not want to develop, or do I want to pay for that and get paid back later? So in this case, he did a latecomers because he installed those pipes in Gemstone and 7th Avenue. And he was expecting to get his money back when those sites developed. So the installation cost is Pete's. And this site here is the Guadalupe Haven site. Now, Guadalupe Haven normally would have had to install those pipes so that they would have something to connect to. But in this case, they didn't have to install the pipes because they were already there. So what they had to do is I wrote a condition of approval that said, you need to cut a check and give it to Olson Homes, and now you've essentially paid for your pipes that you would have had to pay anyways.
So all that, that's all registered and filed and whatever the cost was for that?
Yes. So what happens is Pete actually, now in this case, when it went in 2012, is Pete filed a application to the city, and it says my cost is for stormwater like $17-$18 a foot, and his sewer charge was something like $32 a foot. And so he calculated it out, 529 times each of those, and so they have a water bill and a sewer bill. And every year that amount goes up by the CPI, or the cost of living increase, year after year, so that number keeps going up. But theoretically, Pete had to petition to the city council, and the planner would have brought that before you and said, okay, the dollar bill amount is $18, and here's why he says it's 18. You are, as the council, entitled to say, no, it really should be 15, because you've added this and it doesn't count, and you've added this and it doesn't count. Or you could say, you know, we agree that this number is warranted. So you set it up, and ultimately the council has the right to increase it or decrease it or accept it the way it is. If you accept it, what I would do as a staff member is I would take that and I would record it against all of the parcels that you feel should be assessed that fee. So in this case, there's 529 feet on the north side, and there's 529 feet on the south side, and there's 524 feet on the east side and the west side. But in this case, these homes are already developed. So you might say, no, I don't want you to do half for the houses and half for the open field. It should all go to the empty field. Or you might say, okay, half of it goes to the empty field, but because the other side is developed, maybe we want the taxpayers to pay for that half. That's your right to decide how to spend the sewer and the water money that's in the fund and decide whether ultimately the developer of these empty lots should pay their fair share, theoretically. But ultimately, in this case, you're deciding who pays Pete back because he's the one who invested the money. You determine whether he gets latecomers fees or not. You could totally abandon Pete and say, sorry, you don't get any of that money back because whatever reason you see fit. And theoretically, as long as it could hold up in court, if he sued us for all of that lost latecomers, you know, he could always do that. But generally, what he's going to say is, these are the costs that I've attributed. If you think they're fair, then you can assign it to those developers to pay those latecomers at a later date. So does that make sense? Now, Guadalupe Haven, in this case, they've cut a check to Pete for, you know, $18,000 and $79,000, I think the numbers were. So they cut those checks and gave them to Pete. So they've paid for the infrastructure in the street. Now, what they do is they have 9 buildings that they want to do connections on. So they will submit applications to Terry that says, I want a 6-inch line on this building. And Terry says, okay. So it's going to cost you X amount of dollars to buy into the city's water system. And it is specifically, in this case, maybe the right to use that well house and the water that comes out of that well house that's going to come up that pipe. So you're paying, your money is going towards the infrastructure that was built.
That's fine and dandy as long as that's a new customer.
Yes.
Okay, so what if you have an existing customer, and this is just a for instance, but you have an existing customer that has numerous connections on the water system and has been paying for them for 20 years and also pays a charge for a fire flow protection system that hope to God they never use, but they're being billed for it at the tune of $2,500 a month. And their payment to the city annually for the water that they use, currently use, mm-hmm. is over $100,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But they're not a new customer, but they want a new connection. They want to put in a 4-inch line off of an existing system that's been paid for over 20 years.
Sure.
And you're going to charge them $17,000?
Sure. Theoretically.
And they have to go out and pay to have the installation done.
Yes. Right. So when they want that 4-inch tap, they will pay 2 fees to the Public Works Department. One of them is to get the Public Works guys to go out and dig the hole and tap the pipe and bury it back
but
up.
They've already been...
Yes, so that's the site fee. So you're getting back to general...
No, that's facility. Under the general charge, the 20, the 280, 16, or 16280A4 is the charge. For $1,200.
Yes, so that's okay, the site facility.
But two, which is the second one, the general facility, mm-hmm. two is the one with all the different rate schedules.
Yes. So So my argument would be, and Terry can correct me if I'm wrong, so the extra capacity that they are now going to use in that system for the 4-inch line, so they are theoretically increasing their use, so in that case, they are paying to subsidize well 9, because well 9 is the increase to the capacity that our system needs. So in that case, they would never pay an additional general facility fee if they're not adding more capacity to their site. So if you added a caretaker's residence and you needed a 1-inch line, then you would pay the fee to connect, plus that extra water that you're now using is the general facility fee, because you're now starting to tax well 9 just a little bit more.
So if this, for instance, customer, if this customer did not take any more water through that 4-inch line, then they could actually come back to the city to get reimbursement for the payment that was made to increase that size?
That's a good question. Terry might be able to clarify that. But theoretically, if they were drawing water out of their 4-inch line beyond the meter, then theoretically it's already metered under the 4-inch. I would assume that makes sense. Like, for example, down there behind the movie theater, we have Josh Tovar is just almost getting certificate of occupancy on his new triplex. So in that case, he has one line, but he has 3 meters. So he is looking at theoretically 3 bills. He is looking at 3 general connections, because each one of those units is contributing to the overall infrastructure of the city.
Okay.
So they're paying their share towards well 9, which is theoretically that extra capacity that we keep building. Whereas, you know, somebody on Oak and 12th, where I used to rent, they're not paying for well 9 expansion because they're not subject to general connection fees or general facility fees and site fees. They're just paying their regular bill, which is theoretically their maintenance and their water.
But still back to the connection fee. Say, why are we charging for the customer to cut the street when the customer is actually doing all that? Is what you're saying, John, right?
Yeah.
So all the city's doing is
built-in charges.
The city's going in and they're drilling the hole in the pipe and then setting the valve, and then the contractor comes and hooks everything up.
Yeah. Yes. So now we're talking about questions.
You have no skin in the game unless you want to do it all yourself. Then you can charge.
Yes.
Just a tap is pretty much all they do.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. So now you're talking about what should those connection fees be set at?
Then you need to erase this and say that.
So we're talking about a separate issue. In a sense, we're talking about a third dimension to what I'm describing as a two-dimensional problem. Whether that fee is set at $400 or $4,000 is a question that, as the operators of the system, that you will be talking about in your rate setting. If you wanted to go to a total cost recovery rather than a flat rate, you could do that. That is a rate setting issue.
Yeah, because like John just said, you said dig up the pipe, tap into the pipe, install the connection, lay the pipe in the property line, and bury the pipe again. That's not happening. You're just tapping into it.
Yeah, so you need to get rid of that.
Yes.
No, you need to get rid of that entirely, because all you're doing is charging for making a charge.
To cover the costs associated with the labor, equipment, material, and the restoration for the costs for the connection. He put 4 examples, and he listed a bunch of examples of what that could be. But he's not saying
provided that that's ever done, it's not being done.
Yes.
You understand what we're saying?
In some cases, yes, that's totally true.
Like, so don't give that example, because it's not being done.
Okay.
It's not being done. It's a water
hookup fee. In this case, we're talking to pay for previous infrastructure costs.
Yes.
And in this case, this actually came up just today because when we were talking to Pete about Stage Stone 8 and the connection of the 7th Avenue sewer line to the 14th Avenue project, we had talked about the water and the sewer and the stormwater going into Columbia. And Pete's comment was, okay, so I will cut you a check to put the sewer line in the ground. Great, no problem, totally understand that. But his question was, but I want $400 discount for all 36 of my units because you're going to turn around and charge me $400 that once you put that pipe in the ground, you're going to drill holes and put taps to each of my houses. Well, I just paid you to put it in the ground and you want $400? So in that case, he's asking to offset because if he was building it, what he would do is he would install the pipe, install his taps, and then bury it and build the road on top of it. So in that case of Columbia,
how did that conversation end up? Are you willing to do that for him?
Well, we told him we need to bring that to the Facilities Committee to have that discussion because ultimately that's essentially what you're asking for. But
what I'm seeing, Travis, is we're double dipping on the public. We are. And I don't know that that's the way I want to be perceived. And sitting up here, you're not getting around this issue with me. You can look at me in the eye and burn holes at me, but I'm telling you, we're coming across as double dipping on the public out here, and I don't like that. Not from a political standpoint or anything else, but I'm saying that some of these charges for what's not being done, what's not being said is supposed to be done, is not right.
Well, but I would disagree with you because what the general facilities charge is for the infrastructure that's already there.
But that's not what it says right here.
It's just so simple.
And the way that I see it is that it's not we're double dipping against it. It's that the people that are installing and paying these fees are paying the general public who already have their taxes in.
But I started out my, for instance,
that
the customer that I was using as a you know, make believe has been on the system for 20 years. Paid his fair share of the system to be developed by buying water from the city.
Yes.
All he's asking for is another connection.
Well, but another connection pulls resources from the system. Yeah. So you have to pay.
If he increases the volume of water, he's withdrawing. But if he doesn't increase it, he just wants another.
That's an isolated incident. That's very isolated.
And that should be brought to council.
But it's not being addressed.
And it should be addressed.
Okay, so that's why I'm asking you what your solution is. If you, I mean, you can take it isolated incidences, but we're trying to set policy and we're trying to understand that, I mean, his previous presentation was that we are running out of water. And if you go back to that,
To the number of connections,
and if you just look at the number of these that are planned and in the works right now, we're 514 in the hole. So you're talking about isolated incidences, John, that may or may not, and you could be true. I mean, it could be right. But the thing is, we are charging those fees because we have a future obligation to meet the demand, and right now we have a huge demand for water supply in our city. So if those people are going, the reason I'm just going to get it, boil it down to the bottom line.
Okay.
The bottom line for me is, when you're going to expand your water supply, you're drawing on the resource. If you're going to contribute to the water supply, that's different. But you won't contribute because the city supplies. So if the city is going to supply the water, it needs to, and this body needs to guarantee that going forward, we have enough money to supply in the future. If we don't have enough money to supply, yes, you know, you have fees, you have these site fees, and then you have these general fees. It doesn't really matter how you slice it. We need this money to continue to expand our supply.
Okay, but you started off right away from the very beginning saying then there's a... Okay, that needs to be evaluated.
What I want to do is give the city staff the means to evaluate specific things that occur.
Okay.
From different customers and people, so that it's not just, no, that's the way it is. You got to pay this amount.
Sure.
There's no other way.
And then
I wanted to evaluate it, and I want to make sure that we're not, you know, telling somebody, you know, look, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg to do something here in this town.
I think anybody can, because I think you evaluate pretty much all the permits that come in.
Yeah.
And the applications for these types of fees.
Yeah.
So if there's something that somebody wants to address that's out of the normal, like what you're talking about, it's out of the normal realm, you could apply to Travis to review it, and he would be able to do that.
Okay, but say, Gina, you're putting in a house.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got to connect in the street, and you're going to get charged whatever the fee is, $4,000, and that includes cutting the street, digging it out, mm-hmm. tapping it, putting it back in, compacting it, and putting the asphalt back in. That's what that's saying, that's charging you. But you have to hire a contractor to do all that work, but the city's charging you for it, and so you're paying the city for
yeah.
it, and you're paying the contractor. Okay.
Well, once again, it's only a bond amount.
I have to
we're doing all the work.
Taxpayers.
That's exactly right.
If you're building a house on a vacant lot and you want water to the house, it's a $1,200 on the general and it's a $1,200 on the site, and the city does all the work because it's a live main. We tap it. I just did one over here at Josh Tovar's, and our facility fee, our site facility fee, is clear out of kilter. It's $1,200 and it's right now at $7,600.
How much it costs?
That's what it cost us to break even on that street cut. So our rates need to come up on the site facility side, but you still have to have a 1-inch service to the house.
You're talking on the meter part of it?
But just let the meter finish this part, please.
Okay.
Because you also have the option then of hiring your own contractor.
Correct.
Instead of having the city do it. And then, so you have the option, Mark. You can do either one. We don't charge you for both ends.
So in this incident that we had with Mr. Tovar up here, he went to Ron Van Landingham and asked Ron to do it. Ron says, no, the city can do it cheaper than I can do it, $2,400.
And we're taking the shorts.
We took it in the shorts. I computed it out through Varilla on a spreadsheet based on actual time and material cost. Today is over $7,600 for the site.
So that's for a 1.5-inch and
that's
below?
That's 1-inch.
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 Well, 1.5-inch or below, it's $1,200 charge. But anything above 1.5 inches
is time and materials mm-hmm.
plus 15%.
That's admin fee, correct.
Or you can go and get a contractor to do it and see if you can do it cheaper. That, mm-hmm. It's your option. So it's
Moses Lake. When I checked into Moses Lake and some other cities, they don't even do it anymore because the cost is so. The amount of people it takes to do it, the time it takes to do it, the cost it takes to do it, they backed out of it and they give you a meter fee. Here's the cost of the meter. Here's your site or general facility fee. And here's the right-of-way permit. You need to go get your contractor. We'll inspect it. And it has to be done to city standards because of the cost. And I just did that cost and I was going to take it to the water committee and discuss what you're discussing here. Because I had that spreadsheet all filled out, sitting on the water book down there.
So what's the calculation for the general facilities charges?
For
water.
General facility?
Yep.
So it'd be based on meter?
So so 1 inch is $1,200, 1.5 is $2,380. 2 inches, 3820. So what?
So for instance, McCain's got a 4-inch meter for a general facility charge was $11,930.
What was the total bill?
I don't know what the total bill was. Because
okay.
The rest was based on.
It was 17,000.
Uh huh. And the other side is, is drawing water through a 4-inch meter, and you may not draw. You have an inch and a half out there right now, and you have a connection, but you're making another tap and putting a 4-inch meter in, and you're going to use the inch and a half for irrigation.
2-inch.
Okay. So we don't know how much water you're going to drop from the system through that 4-inch. You may a little bit, you may a lot. So it's pretty hard for the city to calculate what you're going to use and make exceptions to the rule.
Well, we didn't argue it. We paid it, but...
No, I get that.
But that 10-inch water line that exists there,
mm-hmm.
we pay $2,500 a month for the use and the right of that. That was our debt to service that was agreed to in 2003. Since 2003, we've been paying $2,500 a month on that 10-inch line. I just think we need to get into this a little bit more deeper in committee and come up with some things
how you arrive at the numbers. From a growth management point of view, this would be a really easy calculation, because what you would look at is, okay, well nine cost $1 million and it earns us 200 more connections. You would simply divide the $2 million or the $1 million by that 200 connections, which would be $5,000 per connection. So the base connection fee would be $5,000. That pays for your share of well nine and the rehab of the water tower or new additional water towers or maintenance, or the maintenance would be separate. That's, you would assess that with increasing costs. Now, if you also had a new tower that was needed for capacity, and that's another $1 million, and it serves, you'd have to decide how many people are going to be served by that additional water pressure. And then it might change that $5,000 connection fee to, you know, $7,000 or $12,000, depending on what it costs to put in that tower.
So, in
which case, you could easily replace this charge with a simple calculation of $7,000.
You're making a very good argument for what I'm claiming is that we're double dipping, because when you pay your bill, when you receive your bill from the city, and there's a basic water fee, you're paying for the infrastructure and the management and the upkeep of the infrastructure that the city has provided to you. And then you are paying your water cost, what the city feels the water is worth that it's conveying to you for you to use. So you're already paying. Once you start that first payment on that first bill that you receive, you are already contributing your share for the system.
For the ongoing maintenance costs, yes.
Okay, but, so I think at this point in the evening, I think we'll take John's suggestion. Let's go back to committee and get into it in further detail. And if there's any additional information that needs to be either discussed or researched, I recommend that you guys let staff know, give them time to prepare, and then we'll come back to council with it. One of the things that Travis did mention was that this was going to the Planning Commission. So I think that this, before it does, I think it needs to be discussed more in detail in committee, and then they can go back, ask the Planning Commission to examine what they view, you know, with regard to this, and then come back to the council. And we'll, if we need to change our code, then we need to change our code. That's what the council has the authority to do. But again, I think that, you know, we've seen adequate presentations tonight that the council understands that we have a water shortage issue here. And if it isn't upon us, when you look at some of the things that are out in front of us, all those projections that Tim gave us were without any growth. That's not what's occurring right now. We have a ton of growth going on, and people wanting to plan, wanting to develop, and wanting to draw on our water supply. So well nine has bought us a few years, but with this type of growth, we need more water, and we need more sources of water, and that's why we have them helping us walk through this. We're looking at a meeting here at the end of this month with elected officials, with state agencies, and with our consultants. We lay out this problem that we have with our shortage, and we're trying to address that in such a way that they will help us through funding through their either their respective departments or capital or some kind of a capital appropriation through either the state and federal government. So as the mayor, as the staff, as our consultants, and as the council, we're all working together towards that. We know we need it. The problem is bigger than we have any money to fund ourselves, and so this is what we're all, I know we all have the same basic goal in mind. There may need to be some changes to that goal, and I'll admit that. Not every situation is covered. But in the meantime, I don't want us to forget what we're doing and what direction we're going in, because the city of Othello is dependent upon the decisions that this council and that some of these elected officials that John and Gina, myself and Wade and Travis have already met with. And we need their help, and I think that we need to continue to work together towards that end. So with that, is there any other business to come before the council tonight? We'll accept the committee reports. And Debbie, there was something you wanted me to remind the council. Oh yeah, the Transportation Benefit District, while that was approved, we need to have another meeting according to our bylaws, and basically it'll be a meeting that Spencer is going to give us the status of you know, the funding and how soon, and then how we can incorporate that into our street planning going forward. So with that, we're going to have a TBD meeting 15 minutes early before our regular council meeting next Monday. I'm sorry. Thanks for straightening me out. Okay. No further business. I'll adjourn tonight's meeting at 8:52 p.m.